Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
I'm Jenna Wortham.
I'm Wesley Morris.
We're two culture writers at the New York Times.
This is Still Processing. We're back.
Hello.
Hi.
This week we're going to talk about Ocean's 8 and Killing Eve and how good it feels to watch women be bad.
Okay. Before we get into our bad girl club moment, talk to me about this bad mood that you're in.
Yeah, okay. I am kind of bummed out about the last 2 weeks of American society. I'm going to get it off my chest.
Go for it.
Kim Kardashian goes to the White House, as we all know, to talk to President Trump about getting this pardon for Alice Marie Johnson, who was convicted for life for drug possession and money laundering. And as a result of her visit, President Trump commutes her sentence. You put that with Sylvester Stallone's pleading with President Trump to get Jack Johnson's conviction overturned from the 1920s or 1930s. Mm-hmm. And you realize that the people that he's probably going to listen to get anything done involving reform of anything or any kind of justice or any just basic policy are people that he thinks are as famous as he is. And that's a bizarre way to conduct policy, but I have a proposition. It's terrible, but I'm just going to throw it out there.
Okay.
He hates Jeff Sessions, his current attorney general. Mm. So why not give the job to Kim Kardashian?
Oh, my God.
And just we'll just feed her all the stuff that she's supposed to be doing. She claims she's for all sorts of criminal justice reform. Like, why not just Trump, fire Sessions, give it to Kim K?
Yeah, I mean, we're already in 1984. Might as well make it the Hunger Games. Like, I'm with you. Can't be worse than it already is.
I mean, it's just nuts. Speaking of which, a powerful thing happened last week when President Trump denied the Eagles their White House visit for having won the Super Bowl. Mm-hmm. I'm from Philadelphia. I will hold my feelings about whether or not I wanted them to go. But, like, that's part of the ritual. You win a major sporting event, you get to visit to the White House. President Trump cancels because he thinks that the Eagles were part of this wave of boycotters. And some of the Eagles didn't want to go, it's true. But anyway, on Wednesday, after the visit was supposed to happen, Malcolm Jenkins, who's a safety for the Eagles, sat in the locker room as part of this press conference. And in front of his locker, he basically held up a bunch of signs.
Are you not going to say anything today or just going to use these posters?
Could you hold it up again? We couldn't see it.
What aren't we listening to?
We're sort of indicating, you know,
best thing ever.
Why he wasn't. Did you see this?
I just saw the memes. You're not listening. And I wanted to die. So please continue.
So he holds up these signs in front of these reporters and they all have these microphones in his face as though he's going to say something.
And they're like, you're not going to talk. You're just going to hold up your signs. Like, they're kind of heckling him, too.
I'm like, you dumbasses. He is speaking.
He is speaking.
So here's what his signs say. You aren't listening. New sign. More than 60% of people in prison are people of color. Nearly 200,000 juveniles enter the adult criminal system each year, mostly for nonviolent crimes. Hashtag stop school pipeline to prison. Then another one. You aren't listening. Colin Kaepernick gave $1 million to charity. Any given night, 500,000 in jail. Sit in jail convicted? No. Too poor? Yes.
Malcolm, are you upset with the White House's decision to cancel the event?
And just the sound of the silence, the bewilderment from the reporters was just palpable. But I'm just really mad at the willful misconstruing that is going on with what these men and women are asking for in protest. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. This isn't about the national anthem. This isn't about, like, disrespecting sports or the country or the troops or anything. This is about bringing attention to an issue that proliferates in this country. And now like, black people can't win. They're not articulate enough.
Right.
Or like, why aren't you speaking? I can't hear what you're saying. But the signs were deafening in their condemnation of not believing or listening to Colin Kaepernick.
Right.
I don't know. Moving on. The Tonys were on Sunday.
I'm so glad you watched these things so I don't have to. Please continue.
They were pretty good, actually. Josh Groban and Sarah Bareilles hosted it. I mean, they mostly did a lot of musical numbers, but they were witty. And they're good hosts for an event like this. But anyway, Ariel Steckel, he won a Tony for Best Featured Actor in a Musical for The Band's Visit. And he plays one of the Egyptian musicians who gets stuck in this Israeli town. And he wins. And he gives this amazing speech about having to hide his Arab identity.
Both of my parents are here tonight. And I have avoided so many events with them because for so many years of my life, I pretended that I was not a Middle Eastern person. And after 9/11, it was very, very difficult for me. And so I concealed and I missed so many special events with them. And they're looking at me right now and I can't believe it.
And it just, I'm just so really captures the struggles that a lot of people have with their identities, especially around this question of like, who do I present myself as when I'm trying to get a role, when I'm trying to get a job? And it was just really interesting that he sort of mounted the source of his shame to being his purpose in life. The upside for him is that at some point he realized that I'm an Arab man. I'm an American Arab, and I have to just accept that. Whether other people want to accept me or not, I have to be able to accept myself. And he's really good in the show, by the way. He earned that Tony. Mm. What's going on with you?
A lot. Well, I want to start off with a recommendation.
Okay.
Which, you know, people who listen to this show know I talk about my skincare routine and kind of what I'm doing and how to sort of keep the glow going. I've started using rosehip oil, which is a pressed seed oil made from wild rose bushes on my skin. I'm on like this like pretty big project to like resurface the surface of my skin because I had a lot of acne growing up. So I have a lot of hyperpigmentation. And so I wear concealer. I really don't want to wear concealer anymore. I want to get to the place where my skin tone is pretty even. Mm-hmm. So this is like part of the ongoing project. Hyaluronic acid was a big part of it, which I mentioned on the show a few weeks ago. Now I'm integrating rosehip oil into my routine. And actually, I was spending a lot of money on it from a company that I don't want to name, but anyone who dabbles in skincare business will probably know which company I'm talking about. But I ran out of this very expensive $90 vial product. And then I was walking down Atlantic and I saw one of those apothecaries run by black people with just vials and bottles and amber colored liquids in the window with like printed labels on them. We've gone to them together before, but I was like, did they have this thing that I'm looking for? So I walked in and I'm just like, rosehip. And the guy's like, yeah. And so he pours me some little vial, like types out the label, puts it on it. And I was like, okay, this might make my skin explode, but it also could totally work. So every day after I shower, my skin is still really damp. I just put like a little bit into my palm and like kind of press it into my cheeks. And let me tell you, my skin is so hydrated. I can feel it healing. I haven't had a breakout in weeks. And it was like $5. So the moral of the story is you can find your bliss on Atlantic Avenue for $5.
In Brooklyn, yes. I live like a block away from such a place, and it's where I get some of my hair products.
It's amazing. It's great. The thing is about rosehip oil, too, I think it's really good for people of color. It's light. It doesn't make your skin greasy. There's apparently a lot of vitamins and nutrients. Google knows better than I do about what this oil can do for your skin. All I'm saying is it's working for me, and that's part of the reason I'm so happy today. So,
oh, well, I'm happy if you're happy.
Yeah, thank you.
What else?
So last week, I went to the movies with my friend Dodai, frequent movie-going partner. She's a member at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. They were having a party. We went to it. It was really fun. The DJ was banging at Mad FX. He was wearing this beautiful pink and green blanket as like an outfit, and it was just like everything. And then I Googled him later, and he does music for Broad City and Skin, so he was like really playing the tunes. But it was a predominantly white environment. The DJ, Dodai and I, and a few people there were the only people of color, and we're all bopping and vibing. And then all of a sudden, the song comes on, and I'm like, what song is this? This is America. Don't catch you slipping now. Don't catch you slipping now. Look what I'm whipping now. It's This Is America, which is a banging song, right? But I don't know how to feel when that song comes on because the video is so viscerally imprinted onto my mind.
Yeah, yeah.
The violence, the dancing, all the symbolism. You know, I think Donald Glover anticipated that song would continue to be a work of performance and a work of art beyond the video and beyond the song itself. And I couldn't help but feel like when I was watching a room full of white people, like really bopping to This Is America, that this is kind of what he wants us to see too. I just had this like strange moment where I was like, this song is fire. It does sound good, but also like, I know y'all saw the video. That thing has trillions of millions of billions of views on YouTube. So what's going on? I think the DJ knew what was up because he transitioned from that to Shania Twain, which, as we know, she said she would have voted for Trump and then apologized for her remarks. So I think there was some interesting social commentary happening on a couple of levels. But I guess I just wanted to ask you, I mean, you know, I know how I feel when All Right by Kendrick Lamar comes on and you see a room full of people who aren't black people and sometimes even black people singing like, we gonna be all right. And I get really protective. I'm like, this song isn't for you. Like, it's so complicated what happens when these works of art leave the artists, right? And they live in the world.
Yep.
But what do we do about that song?
This Is America or any of these songs?
I mean, this specifically, This Is America, because it's really topical right now.
You know, for me, it's very simple because I actually don't like it as a song. I think that the transitions between the parts are too disparate. So it's not something that I'm tempted to get lost in a room full of anybody. So it is an extra anthropological experiment for me to see this song get played in public. And I think you just have to let the song do its work. Either you know what's going on with it or you don't. And one of the things about music that's interesting is if it sounds good, you can kind of be immune to what else it's doing or what else it's saying.
Interesting.
I think Kendrick Lamar is a really good example of that. I mean, there are people who might know what some of this music is about, but I think a lot of people can just appreciate it as music.
Mm.
And, you know, there is a curse of knowing too much, you know?
It's true.
Like, too much knowledge is just a bummer sometimes. And just knowing, being at the Met with This Is America on is its own kind of work of art, right?
That's what I was really appreciating, is how this is a piece of work that doesn't just end with the video or end with the song. It continues to live on. The other update from that event was the DJ played All Mine by Kanye off Yee.
Oh, yeah.
It slapped. Yeah. It sounded great. Yeah. We all got down. I felt conflicted about it, but it held up.
Listen.
You know?
I have not experienced that album in a live space, but I'm looking forward to encountering it.
I had to Shazam it to make sure my ears were hearing what they were hearing.
Mm.
And then I gave up and danced a little bit. I was like, this is complicated. But yeah.
What else?
Well, before we start our show, I think we kind of have to acknowledge just what's been in the ether and what's been going on. And it's been a really, really heavy couple of weeks. Two prominent New Yorkers, Kate Spade and Anthony Bourdain, both took their lives pretty recently back to back. And it's hit a lot of people really, really hard.
Yeah.
I was like weeping openly on Friday. And I think there are people in my life who've struggled with depression. I struggle with depression. I have had many dark moments and I know that pain very intimately. And so I've just been thinking a lot about mental wellness, mental health. We also talk a lot on this show about how to show up for each other and what community means and what our responsibility is to each other. And I was thinking a lot about this over the weekend, and I wanted to reference a few things. One is a piece that was in circulation by a lovely human named Deanna Zantz that we'll link to in our show notes, but also just offers the reminder that you never know what someone's going through, and a way to keep tabs on the people in your life is just to notice if a tone in their text messages or their appearance or even the way they're using social media changes, and just check in with them and not wait for people to tell you, hey, I'm down, hey, I'm depressed, because often that's...
They won't say it.
They won't say it. It's a very difficult thing to admit and even be able to talk about. So just, it's hard. It's weird to say check in because sometimes people lie when you check in. I know I used to. So I think the idea of just trying to be really mindful of what your immediate circle is up to and try to keep a temperature on their mental health is key.
Mm-hmm.
There are also online therapy apps like Talkspace that are helpful. And I feel like I want to mention that the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline number is 800-273-8255, which is a very, very scary number to dial, but I have dialed it before, and I can tell you surprisingly like reassuring. Like it's not mm-hmm. the scariest thing in the world to do. So I just want to put that out there as a resource and just say, you know, if any of our listeners are struggling with depression, you're not alone. We hear you.
Definitely not alone.
And we're all in this together, even if it feels like we're not.
Tumi has a soft side. Discover their new Azra bag collection in its pillowy pleats, satin finish, and crescent shape. Azra is the bag to carry for your 9-to-5 and your 5-to-9 plans that follow. Versatility, after all, is Tumi's signature. Shop the full Azra collection on Tumi.com or at a Tumi store near you.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Jenna, when I was in high school, I had a teacher. She did something to me that I didn't like. She was probably right for doing it, but I didn't like it anyway. And I was telling my friend Sean, you know what? She did this thing to me that I didn't like. And I need a word to describe her for how much I don't like it. And neither of us liked the word bitch because it didn't seem fair. We just thought it was reductive. Mm-hmm. We decided that dick wasn't good enough because she didn't have one.
Well, that you knew of, but yeah, fair.
And then we were kind of like, well, could she be an asshole?
Right.
Does asshole seem right? But we decided that asshole was great because she had one of those.
Right.
And she was exercising a kind of power that we recognize in men who we call assholes. And she just didn't care whether or not, like, my feelings were hurt. It just was kind of fun to sit there for, like, 10 minutes and think about what other women assholes do we know? We didn't have that many, but it was a fun exercise to do because we felt like we'd come up with a new way of thinking about women that wasn't limited to this one sort of boring conventional way of thinking of them as bitches.
And what you were identifying in a way too was that there is a type of woman that operates out of a paradigm of like niceness or social acceptability and who has agency.
Yes.
This is someone who didn't care what you thought of her. She didn't care if you liked her. She needed to put you in your place.
That was Ms.
And that
Wagner.
Made her an asshole.
Yep.
Shouts to that. And also, in case you hear this, Ms. Wagner, shout out to you for just living your truth and not backing down to teenage boys who actually are the true assholes in this story. So what we're trying to do today is talk about what it looks and feels like when women break bad and what it feels like to see them on screen and what the conditions are that lead them to go off kilter. If we're even calling them that, because frankly, I feel like all women have this capacity inside of them. And I'm a bad girl a certain number of days of the week. You just don't always see it. Anyway, when we talk about women behaving badly, are they really assholes, or is there a broader spectrum of them behaving in a way we're not accustomed to? And what does it mean to see it on screen now?
I mean, I definitely think that was the deal with me and Sean and Ms. Wagner. I was thinking about how much pleasure I get from a certain kind of bad behavior as executed by women. I was thinking about that while I was watching Ocean's 8, a heist movie with, you know, name a woman and she's in it. And Killing Eve, this great show on the BBC about an intelligence officer trying to catch a serial killer.
And quick, before we jump in, spoiler warning alert. I love spoilers. I know most people don't. This show is going to be full of them with regards to Killing Eve and Ocean's 8. So just quick notice, you've been warned.
You know, there's this moment in Killing Eve, the first episode, where you are introduced to this psychopath serial killer. And you see her watching a girl eating ice cream in a coffee shop.
Yeah.
And the girl is kind of enjoying the ice cream, and she's watching everybody sort of respond to the cuteness of the girl and watching the girl eat. And she's picking up all these cues from the people around her about how to respond to something that's cute. And she kind of gets the face right of joy and ecstasy and like amusement, but it's slightly unhinged looking too, because her eyes are a little too wide and her smile's a little too wide. And then like they have this connection. The girl's like, I see you seeing me. And then the woman, we eventually learn her name is Villanelle, keeps staring in a way that kind of begins to make the girl feel a little bit uncomfortable. And then you feel uncomfortable because this is not the way an adult woman looks at a little girl. And at some point, the woman gets up to leave the cafe, and she walks on her way out of the cafe. She knocks the girl's ice cream off the table. And she
into
just,
her lap.
And yes, into her lap. And she just enjoyed the hell out of doing that. And that's, it's just like...
That's the moment I knew I was going to like this show.
That's the moment I knew I was going to like this show, too.
You know, we all have impulses, and we all have impulses to do things that are not socially acceptable, and they're downright... kind of awful. And just the fact in that exact moment, they establish this is a woman who acts on every impulse, whether we can think of them as good or bad, decadent or indulgent or not. She was like, this is what I feel like doing, and I'm doing it. And I never see that on screen. So for me, I was like sold. And there's another scene too, where she's watching someone through a pair of binoculars, and she's eating the most like oily piece of bruschetta with a big fat piece of mozzarella on it, and she takes a tomato and crushes it over the bread.
Oh, that's such a brilliant
bread,
food
and then
trick.
Tosses the tomato over her hand, doesn't care about wasting it, and just eats with such relish, and then starts her mission, which is to kill a person,
right,
which she enjoys as much as she enjoyed that piece of bruschetta. And I also think, you know, she's slim because it's Hollywood, but at the same time, she's curvy.
She's curvy.
She loves fabrics. She loves champagne. She just takes obvious pleasure in things that women are usually deprived of on screen. I don't know the last time I've seen a woman eat something, clearly eat something. Like, usually they're just sniffing the food and pretending to take a bite. She like shoves it in her mouth and the juice is like running down her face. This is just a person who is living to an extreme that women are rarely granted.
Yeah, it's such a window into the priorities of this show. We should say it's based on a couple of novels, but is as television a product of Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who is a woman who made this show Fleabag, which was a very different show about these same run-amuck id scenarios, but they were sort of born of a different sort of emotional trauma. This is this woman applying that sort of emotional freedom to what to me is a very sort of standard entertainment platform, which is the cat and mouse thriller between a person doing bad and a person tasked with catching that person. Mm. And the quote twist unquote here is that both the cat and the mouse are played by women. And one of the things I think this show is asking is like, what changes when the genders are different? What changes when you have one woman trying to catch another woman under these very sort of boilerplate circumstances?
I would also argue that the show is trying to ask a question, what do women do when there are no men around? What do women think about, dream about, talk about when they aren't worried about being interesting or appealing or an object of desire for a man? Both of these women have relationships with men in different ways as colleagues,
spouses,
you know, partners, but they operate almost entirely independently of them. They establish that really early on, that neither of these women are really concerned with the men in their lives and appealing to them.
So I was really thinking about the pleasure of watching a woman be an asshole in the opening sequence of Ocean's 8.
As you know, parole is a privilege.
It's a mistake, but it happened. And if I were to be released, I would just want the simple life. I just want to hold down a job, make some friends, you know, pay my bills.
It begins with Sandra Bullock getting out of prison, and she's released, and she does this whole penance thing in the front of the parole board, and she basically is let go, and Then you see what she's wearing on her way out, and she's got this really amazing evening gown on.
Evening gown, and yeah.
The trench coat over it. And then she leaves, and she has no money, basically, and she has no way of getting anywhere near her old life. As you're watching this woman scam her way into this hotel, you are aware that you are watching a real exercise of, like, a kind of white lady privilege.
Yes.
And you've never seen a non-white woman get out of prison the way Sandra Bullock gets out of prison in this movie.
Right.
But you were also watching a woman be very comfortable in her being an asshole. And it just was so fun to watch the kind of venality on screen that you see a George Clooney or a Mark Wahlberg or a Denzel. I mean, it's just done so calmly and so effortlessly. And I just really liked watching that. And it's a mode that you don't experience too often with your big female movie stars anymore.
I would say, though, what makes the scams in her case okay is that she's not really pulling them over on people. She's pulling them over on systems.
Yes.
The prison system, you know, the corporate capital system that allows these extravagant, exorbitant hotels to even exist in the first place. She's scamming, like, you know, if there's a spectrum of, like, people that are okay to scam, it's never going to be, like, you know, poor, undeserving. Like, she's not stealing identities of homeless people or elderly women.
Right.
She's, like, robbing someone who probably won't even notice that their hotel bill has been extended a couple of days, or someone who hasn't noticed.
Yes,
they've lost
a
fur coat from a rack. I just want to put her scammeriness into context, which is not, like, she's just out to get over on the world.
No, right. It's simultaneously generic enough to be morally satisfying, or satisfying without any sort of moral complications.
And you're right. I mean, there's a degree of satisfaction that comes in both these properties, Ocean's 8 and Killing Eve, that comes from watching women operate outside of the paradigm of normalcy that we assume women are supposed to behave within. Mm. So it's fun watching women really just give in to their id and eat a lot, drink a lot, have sex a lot. Sometimes kill a lot. Just do all these things that we, I'm using air quotes, don't think, like, good girls do. And then they do it with such grace and finesse and humor that it makes it really enjoyable.
The degree of competence that goes into pulling off this heist is very satisfying.
I have to tell you my one grievance with Ocean's 8, and then I want to tell you what I loved about it.
Okay.
You ready?
Yes.
It is a crime that they filmed scenes of that movie in the lobby of the New York Times.
I was just about to, I don't.
And no
I
one
just,
told me.
No, not, not
Rihanna
just. Yeah, okay, there
was
go.
Here. Rihanna was here in the building that we're sitting in right now. Listen, I don't know who signed that movie permit. Didn't let your girl Jane Deluxe know about it. We have a bone to pick.
I mean, I do not think this is a great movie. I think it's barely good, but at the same time, there is just something really nice in the scenes where they're setting up the job, and you have this array of, you've got Sarah Paulson sitting next to Mindy Kaling and trying to work things out with Sandra Bullock and Kate Blanchett. And I enjoyed that in a way that had nothing to do with gender in some ways, right? You just have this great presentation of actors and movie stars problem solving together, like problem solving in terms of what the plot requires them to do, the problems presented by the job. That was fun for me. I loved that. I love a world in which Sandra Bullock and Kate Blanchett are best friends, you know,
and potentially former lovers.
Potentially,
I mean, there was an
lovers.
Underlying sexual tension throughout the entire movie that was so delightful. And I wanted to be complicated about it, and I wanted it to bother me a little bit.
Wait, why does the gay thing annoy you?
Because sometimes it's a way to add a layer of titillation that's never going to have a payoff. I mean, you see it in a show like Riverdale. Betty and Veronica always have this flirtation, like maybe they're going to get together, but it doesn't ever pay off because they're so invested in their boyfriends. And I'm not saying those characters can't be queer, and I'm not saying these characters can't be queer, but I just didn't want to feel like they were doing it for the pleasure of men that might be watching, that there's not going to be a sexy striptease or a moment where we see a silhouette behind a shower curtain in this movie. So we got to give the boys something. So we're going to we're going to hint at maybe these girls got it on at some point. But they didn't reduce it to that in the movie. It felt so subtle, and it also felt really authentic to the way that women do flirt with each other, whether or not they've ever been in a sexual relationship. And it didn't trigger me in the ways that I thought it might.
No, it feels legitimately just sexy. And the chemistry these women have veers into flirtation.
But then Brad Pitt and George Clooney kind of flirt in the same way too. And
exactly,
there's a tension that I just really enjoyed. And I think when you have women teasing each other and flirting with each other and there are no men in view, except potentially in the audience, which they're not even aware of in theory, it's like really, it's really charged and way more erotic than I thought possible. I loved it. And again, there's like these subtleties that are operating on all these levels about how women are supposed to think about other women, what it even means for this many women to be helping each other.
Yeah. I want to ask you some questions, though, because the world in which this movie is set is decidedly not male, right? And I don't mean that there are no men present, because there are men on the periphery of it. But we're talking about Jules. We're talking about the Met Ball, which is the site of their hit. And we're talking about Helena Bonham Carter playing this washed up, but resurrected
exquisite
fashion designer.
My gosh.
Who I think she's supposed to be Vivienne Westwood.
Yeah. Everyone knows. Okay. Yeah, clearly.
I loved how feminine this world was to me in some ways. And I mean that in the best, most enthusiastically endorsed way possible. You're seeing costuming taken seriously. You're seeing like jewel craft taken seriously. You're seeing the Met Gala treated as a legitimate site of a caper. Mm-hmm. I loved taking all this frippery and giving it a dimension of at least like thematic heft. But you know, if George Clooney, Matt Damon, and Don Cheadle and Brad Pitt were to do this in an Ocean's movie, it would be a joke. Right?
It would be a Judd Apatow movie.
Right. It would be, I mean, it'd be a farce. It wouldn't just be some caper movie where these...
It'd be Neighbors 4.
Right.
This is a movie that looks at things we think of as feminine and elevates them or neutralizes them.
It just completely neutralizes them.
And the joke within the movie, too, is that these women can all wear many faces. They can be a caterer. They can put on a ball gown. They can escape unnoticed. They can be a repair person. That they can move undetectedly as long as they're completely aware of how they function as women. And I think that surfaces in the movie several times. There's a moment when Sandra Bullock's like, you know, we can't have any men in this operation because men get noticed. And she's commenting in a lot of ways on how people don't pay attention to women. They notice them, but they don't really feel like they're a threat or they need to do anything with them. And I think that's part of the sophistication in this film is that the characters are deeply aware of how they function as women in the world and how they can use that to their benefit to be criminals.
But they know they're women and they know that sexism exists and they know what the stakes are for their doing this job. It's just really subtle. And the subtlety is much appreciated is what I would say. And it's a subtle critique of the movie industrial complex too. This is an industry that often, in order to acknowledge its discriminatory practices, has to do something that's explicitly addressing the crime being committed. And often, this I think was the cultural problem that the Ghostbusters movie had to deal with, right? Which was, hey, we don't have enough stuff with women. Let's take an old thing, redo it, and just repopulate it with women. And the way that was presented to us, obviously, it brought out all the trolls to hate it.
Right, right, right.
But it also kind of disturbed the movie in a lot of ways because you couldn't go to that movie and enjoy it as Kate McKinnon, Melissa McCarthy, Kristen Wiig, and Leslie Jones having a good time together. The stakes were too high and you weren't going to a movie. And I mean, I've said this before, but you were going into an election booth, right? You were going to cast a vote for Ghostbusters.
Ooh.
And you weren't going to enjoy these four women be great together.
So smart. That's so good.
And I just feel like that movie had to be a sacrificial lamb for something like this.
But why does this feel like it's showing you, like it's shining a flashlight on a path ahead? Because it seems like that's what we're getting at with this and Killing Eve.
Because for one thing with Ocean's 8, they explain it. Like Sandra Bullock is George Clooney's sister in this movie. And it doesn't feel as desperate because there's no reason for Ghostbusters to exist again. Those guys can still bust ghosts.
You're so funny. Okay, I got you.
And I feel like Ocean's 8, like, of course Danny Ocean probably has a sister who's off committing her own crimes.
Right.
Like, that just makes all the sense in the world to me. Do I wish people didn't have to rely on intellectual property to keep making movies? Of course. Damn the IP.
But in terms of a, yeah, like but, in terms of a cultural landscape where this movie, right. this storyline might exist, right. it makes a lot more sense.
This movie can justify itself to me in a way that a lot of other things cannot. So I am satisfied
All right.
with the existence of this movie.
Ugh, you're so good.
I mean, I guess that is really why I love Killing Eve so much, though, which is that it is basically an original visual property. It's based on a series of books by Luke Jennings called Codename Villanelle. And I love that you, again, have this thing that is already established. You have these, you know, the procedural cat and mouse thriller.
Mm-hmm.
And what then does it mean to have two women do these jobs?
Mm.
And not dwell on the womanness of it as a matter of politics, right? Like, I think that the thing that we've had a hard time as a culture getting our brains around is women doing things.
Mm.
You know, women doing anything Gosh. That we've always seen men do.
Jeez.
I said it was probably a woman. Victor Kedron was a misogynist and a sex trafficker. He may not have considered a passing woman a threat.
There's a moment in the first episode where Sandra Oh, who plays Eve, and she's so good on this show, is explaining to the people at MI6 where she works, or
mm-hmm.
MI5,
mm-hmm.
that she thinks that the killer is a woman.
She must have been able to get close. I want to meet that witness. If I'm right,
no,
then...
No, not your job. Please don't make this a thing. I'm feeling very fragile.
I'm telling you, it's a woman.
And nobody believes her.
Mm-hmm.
And the
mm-hmm.
men are like, oh my God, are you kidding me with this? There's no way. Like, what's your proof? You need to prove to us that you think it's a woman. And she's kind of like, I kind of really can. It's just a feeling I have. And I was like, I can hear that.
Mm-hmm.
Because the
mm-hmm.
impulse, I mean, with these movies, always when a woman speaks, it's like, well, you got to have double the amount of proof a man would. A man could walk in here tomorrow and be like, that's a lady.
I think there's also a piece of connective tissue between Killing Eve and Ocean's 8 in terms of how the women deploy a deep inner intelligence about how women function in the world,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Like, they're keenly aware of what it means to be looked at and how to attract attention and also how to repel it.
Mm-hmm.
So they know how to attract attention, be decoys and foils, and they know how to also disappear into the landscape and make themselves unnoticeable and blend into the scenery. And maybe that's by dressing down or not wearing makeup or whatever. It's like they've figured out how to put on the disguises of womanhood and also take them off.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of indicates a kind of sophistication for an understanding of how the world treats women generally, that they both can use as a tool in their belt as much as a shiv or
yep.
a poison-filled pen or whatever else Villanelle or the women of Ocean 8 use to get ahead or get what they want. It's exciting to watch women be gluttons, and they're gluttons for work, for fabrics,
yes,
for fashion,
yes, yes,
and not feel a need to hide it,
mm-hmm.
right? And I think the pleasure of the show comes in watching these two women circling around each other and understanding that they are in some ways cut from a similar cloth and yet wildly different. And I feel them inspecting each other for clues on how to be.
Yes. But I just wonder whether or not the thing that you've so brilliantly identified as being the sort of source of attraction for Eve is the freedom that Villanelle seems to have to her.
Right.
And her competence at her job is something that Sandra Oh has. And she probably knows that she's really good at her job too, but she doesn't feel free in the way she thinks Villanelle feels free.
Towards the end of the series, there's a moment when Sandra Oh, who's playing Eve, gets into Villanelle's derelict, but really fashionably so, Paris apartment. And she starts going through all of her stuff. And she's like looking in the closet. And then she yanks open the fridge and it's just full of champagne. And she just lets out this laugh and then grabs the bottles and just starts guzzling it, but can't even, you know, there's a hilarious moment where she's trying to guzzle it and just like gorge on this liquid and then chokes because A, you can't drink champagne that way, but B, it's like comedy about her having no experience drinking champagne.
Yeah.
And she sort of starts to like adopt this swagger, I guess the way maybe she thinks Villanelle functions in this space. But then she takes it in a totally different direction where she starts trashing the apartment as though she thinks this is kind of what being bad looks like or her version of bad. Villanelle catches her in the act and they kind of have this comedic moment. And I think for me, that's when the show really becomes about a type of vulnerability and trust and maybe the performance that they're both playing drops a little bit. And it starts to become of this moment of, do we trust each other? And what does that start to look like? And these are things that I feel like I rarely see on screen, and it just felt much more meaningful than whether or not this woman's going to catch this other bad criminal.
And I love the idea that this woman's name is Eve. You know, I mean, like a woman who basically has been created by higher powers and like of man. And what does it mean to be off that leash even for a minute? And you get to function independently with, dare I say, a Lilith? Okay, so we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to try to talk about whether it means more to have these properties now in what we're calling a Me Too era.
We'll be right back.
This year, a very important public figure turns 80. He sent us his wish for his birthday.
My wish is for everyone to practice wildfire safety, because only you can prevent wildfires.
That sounds easy enough. Bet you don't know who it is. Nah, of course you do. It's Smokey Bear. Let's all make sure Smokey's wish comes true by learning his wildfire prevention tips at SmokeyBear.com. Because Smokey Bear lives within us all. Brought to you by the USDA Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Okay, Wesley, we just spent a whole lot of time breaking down Killing Eve and Ocean's 8 and looking at what it feels like to watch women subvert the male gaze and look at themselves and look at each other, which is revolutionary and really exciting. But it doesn't escape me that these are both materials, the source materials for both of these properties were created by men. Even if it feels very FUBU in execution, can it be if men originally wrote these stories and created these female personas that are being acted out in these different ways?
But I do think that there is room for people to be pushing back against and challenging at least the conscriptions that we put around the way women operate in popular culture. And I don't think you need to be a woman in order to loosen that up a little bit. It's easy for me to sit here and say, well, you know, there are a lot of great directors who write great parts for women. You know, I can say wonderful things about Pedro Almodovar all day long. But I'm also interested in having more people like Lucrecia Martel, this great Argentine filmmaker who's made two really great movies about women and their inner lives. And Holy Girl is one of them, and La Cienega is another, and The Headless Woman is another. I want to see what more women would or could do.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and I feel like Killing Eve, part of what's exhilarating about it is I just feel like all of those touches come from Phoebe Waller-Bridge.
That's
and
fair.
They're totally original and subtle, and they have this great mix of comedy and suspense and grossness, things that are really tonally almost impossible to pull off. This show pulls off three times an episode. I don't know. It's a question worth asking, but again, it's the thing that we always point to, which is let everybody do stuff and you don't have to ask these questions.
Yeah.
But I mean, one of the screenwriters on Ocean's 8 is a woman. And, you know, I wonder what the conversation was about, like having Gary Ross make that movie and not like Penny Marshall.
Sure. Right. So if we had to identify something that these shows are encapsulating or filling a gap, what do we think it is? Is it they're giving us a sense of what women-identified camaraderie can look like, where women need each other more than ever, or that they, you know, I don't know. I'm curious.
I'm hearing you.
It's interesting to see filmmakers and TV producers try to imagine how women move forward together in alignment while acknowledging the inherent badness of men really is kind of what's also happening in these movies too. It's like, that's a given, but here's what's going to happen when we come together and do things, I guess, you know, stereotypically bad behavior.
I think what I like about them is that this isn't a direct argument for overturning patriarchy, right? I don't think there's any one rule. I do think that having something like the Bechdel test, which is very simple, it's two women talking to each other about something other than a man.
Right.
That is a useful indictment of the way the entertainment industry typically has tended to function.
And the origin, we should say, came from a comic strip called Dykes to Watch Out For by cartoonist Alison Bechdel, which everyone should pick up that anthology. It's available online. I got it recently. It changed my life.
Yeah, I think it's useful to have a standard by which to evaluate the success of culture that includes women. But I also think that that's a criterion specific to a particular type of movie going. And I think for a lot of years, it was useful just to determine whether or not a movie had women doing anything of interest in it. I would take Alison Bechdel's standard and I would add to it just, are these women interesting to me? I hate the word interesting. I know I just used it. But all I'm really talking about is, does this person have any inner life whatsoever? Do they have a personality? Are they funny? Are they emotional? Are they smart? Are they even stupid? Are they interestingly stupid? You know, there's a character in Mean Girls that, you know, the—
Oh, absolutely. I mean— You're talking about dimension. You want someone who's 3D, not 2D.
Right. Do they exist as people or as interesting characters who aren't necessarily assigned the task of toppling anything? Which, parenthetically, I would take, but it shouldn't be the explicit aim. Because I think there are ways to challenge this stuff without necessarily dropping a bomb on it. And I think that is the thing about an Oceans movie, like an all-female Oceans movie.
Right.
Which is that it can be just as frivolous and occasionally dumb as any other movie.
Right.
But also be of interest because we are seeing something that we don't typically see.
Okay, I got you.
Does that make sense?
Yes, of course. It's like, why should every property involving a woman or multiple women have to deal with fighting the patriarchy? They can also ignore it. And there is discrete pleasure in both. And actually, frankly, for movies that do involve more and all and exclusively ideas about men, they should be fighting the patriarchy too. I mean, what we always want on the show is the same thing, which is just more, better, faster, harder. We just want like more of the stuff that makes us feel
human.
Yeah, human. Yeah.
I think that one of the solutions is just like it is always going to be let more people make more stuff.
And maybe a nice way to end the show too is just that these are our recommendations for the types of things we always ask for more of on this show, which are cultural properties that interrogate identity, construction, deconstruction, that give non-typical subjects a voice and a palette and a range, a breadth. And these are great examples of both.
Right. And you also just, you don't have to tell us that that's what you're doing. You can just do it.
Right.
You don't have to tell us you're toppling anything. Just knock it over. Jeez. That's our show.
Still Processing is a product of the New York Times.
It's produced by Nina Patak.
Our editor is Sasha Weiss.
We get editorial oversight from Lisa Tobin and Samantha Hennig.
Our engineer is Jake Gorski.
And our theme music's by Kindness. It's called World Restart from the album Otherness.
You can find all of our episodes and various things at nytimes.com/stillprocessing.
And if you feel so compelled, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye, everybody.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.